And good afternoon and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink and Laurent Landis. Our guest today is Willie Wilkinson. Willie is a writer, a public health consultant, and a cultural competency consultant, which completely leaves the two of you out across the table there. The competent part.
Maybe not
the cultural part.
The cultural part, you're cultural, but you're not competent.
Gotcha.
Willie will explain to you what it is that part of it is.
Okay.
Willie, your new book is Born in the Edge of Race and Gender. Welcome to Lambda Weekly.
Okay, hold on a second.
Oh.
Now.
Now you're on?
Now we're on.
Hi, Willie. How
Hi,
are
Willie.
You?
All right. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay, great. Yeah, calling in from Oakland, California. How are you?
We're good. How are you?
Good.
Well, happy thank you for taking part of your Sunday to be on the oldest, longest-running gay and lesbian and bisexual transgender radio show on anywhere in the world.
Great. That's exciting.
Yeah, we've been on since like 1983. Willie is and you know, normally if this had nothing to do with the story, we wouldn't mention it if we were just talking about public health consultant or something. But this has a lot to do with the book. Willie is a female-to-male transgender man. Right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And has three children.
Wow, that's a handful.
I know. Laurent has one, and we always just look at him and just shake our heads.
He swears no more.
No more.
One.
No more. One is enough.
Yep, I got three little ones, too. They're busy.
Oh, my God.
And one of the chapters in your book, which really spoke to me, is called Allergic to Children.
Yes, I saw that.
Tell us about that. Let's start off right there. Tell us about being allergic to children, which Patty and I both are.
Well, that was the line that my mother used as a first grade teacher. And, you know, she would had a way of warming up the little kids when they were wide-eyed little six-year-olds and just kind of teasing them and calling them by a different name and goofing with them. And then once they warmed up, then she'd back off and say, I'm allergic to children.
Mm-hmm.
that was this kind of a shout-out to my mom and her as this wacky teacher that drove a camel to school and lived in a treehouse. And the kids, you know, it was all normal to the kids at age six, right? But I grew up with a twisted sense of reality.
Yeah, I saw that. How you talked, your mom also talked about how she also went to school on the hippopotamus and several other things.
Oh, yes. It changed from year to year. And then at one point, the kids would look and be like, wait a minute, that's not a hippopotamus. And they saw her on the street. She's like, well, you know, the hippopotamus needed a break, so I'm driving the Dodge Dart today. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So with your mom, she sounds like she was in the book, sounds like a very loving, but yes, and somewhat eccentric woman. Was that helpful in your journey?
Well, I mean, you know, and I do also talk about the challenges that she had around my gender identity, but, you know, I grew up in a multicultural home that we really celebrated our traditions. You know, particularly the Lunar New Year, and you know, she had a lot of fun ways of approaching learning as a first grade teacher.
Hmm. Now, when you say, let's just be real clear what we're talking about when you say multicultural home racially. Explain to everybody what you're talking about.
Well, ethnically, I can tell you what my heritage, but in terms of the multicultural experience, it's broader than that. But,
sure.
You know, my mom is Chinese from Hawaii, and my father is English, Irish, Scottish from Oakland, and I grew up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. But, you know, Hawaii is a very multicultural environment, so I grew up with a lot of those traditions that are in Hawaii, Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Hawaiian. Mm-hmm. Korean and Portuguese, and so, you know, there was a multicultural way that we approached food and traditions, and just, you know, we did the dreidel song, you know, because it was just important to do a lot of different traditions and learn about them, you know, but in particular for us, we celebrated Chinese New Year with a flair and flamboyance that was like no other folks around, and we would have four parties over two weekends. celebrating the Lunar New Year, and we would create paper mache masks of the new year and the old year, and then at a certain point there would be firecrackers and the gong ringing, and then we would dress up as the new year or the old year, and the new year would chase out the old year. While my mom rang the gong, my dad, my brother did the firecrackers and all the drunk people would just like jump back, grab their, you know, clutching their dim sum and just get out of the way as we chased the old year out. So that's what we did. you know, old year meaning, you know, the animal, the years, the animals,
yes,
of the Chinese zodiac.
Right, yeah.
So coming up on the year, yeah, so.
So you grew up in San Francisco, and in the San Francisco area, and you know whether it's true or not is believed to be for San Francisco, Oakland outsiders that that's probably one of the most LGBT friendly places on earth. And I just wanted to if you could talk a little bit about how inclusive the LGBT community was for the T in that area.
And what year, what era you're talking about?
Right. It went, first of all, when did you, let me back into this a little bit. When did you first know that you were transgender? Always. Yes?
Well,
pretty much.
Pre-verbal, you know, before there was real language to describe it.
Right.
I had a strong sense that the dolls and dresses assigned to me were not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I rejected them before I could speak. But, you know, when I was 4, I decided I wanted to be white and male, and I was going to work really hard towards that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And at the age of 9, I did change my name to Willie. And so I write about that in the book because, you know, this was in the early 70s. There was, of course, no awareness, no conversation about transgender issues, not in any way that was positive. You know, of course, no systemic support in the schools. And I write about it because it's such an important issue now. You know, so many places around the country, there are trans kids who are struggling for recognition and respect, and being denied their basic equal rights in school settings. And, you know, this is an ongoing issue. And in California, we have the first legislation to honor trans kids so that they can go to school in accordance with their gender identity, and still trans kids are being discriminated against.
Sure.
So that's, you know, that's why I am using my story to illuminate the issue and talk about, you know, what that experience was like, having peers and teachers not really, you know, recognize my name change or see, you know, a lot of times people would taunt me with the old name, and, you know, just be really resistant to understanding that that was actually my name. So it was a long haul.
Well, but if that was in the 70s, that really was early.
Yes, it was.
Especially for female to me. No, for female to male. Yeah, some of us, Patty,
right,
are older than you are.
Okay, then. Well, you know, and you know, of course, you know, and even now, there is so little visibility of trans masculine folks. And back then, of course, there was no visibility of trans men at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there was no resource. There were no resources for me to find that would reflect my experience. And it was a long time before I met somebody like me.
Right.
So you said earlier that you wanted, when you were small, wanted to be white and male. What was the story around being white? What was that about?
Well, I mean, I asked my dad at the age of 4. So are all the people on Money white men? And he said, yes, they're all former presidents. So I thought, well, okay, so that's the only way you can become president. And, you know, that seems like a good goal because my mom in all of her, you know, how should I describe this? You know, her interesting way of approaching, you know, life, she would say, you know, like, your father is the great white hope, and I'm just the humble concubine. I walk 4 steps behind. So she would say these things, and I was like 4 years old going, what is she talking about? What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that it was a good thing to be white and male, and I thought, well, this is something to aspire to. I'm going to try to do this.
And we're assuming you didn't quite meet all of your goal.
But well, you know, I worked it out over time.
That's good.
I got with, you know, and I got with being myself. So that's a good thing. And that's what, you know, hopefully we can all be, you know, happy with who we are, you know.
Yeah, you do talk about that in your book and how once you, you know, came to resolve with yourself that you were not going to be white or that you couldn't be a white male, and how you ended up somehow, I guess, becoming close or really resonating with the African-American community. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did. I mean, because, you know, I came out as when I was in college, you know, it wasn't an option to come out as trans. Mm-hmm. There was no community. There was no real conversation or language around trans identity or gender nonconformity, really. And I came out as a lesbian in college, but, you know, I realized, well, I have to be female in order to do that. So I came out as a woman and as a lesbian and as a woman of color and as a lesbian of color. And I connected, I ended up on the East Coast and then back in the San Francisco Bay Area connecting with lesbians of color and really resonating with a wonderful community of folks. And, yeah, I mean, a lot of the black women were just really just, you know, I really connected with, you know, just the ways in which folks communicated, you know, just the ways in which we, you know, spent time together, the music, dancing, you know, it was just a really nice connection. And so I have really connected with a lot of black folks over time.
Now, and one of the things that you just said, it's actually kind of funny because you said you came out as a woman first because you had already been identifying as male.
Well, you know, I always saw myself as male, but then, you know, I was.
But to be a lesbian, you had to be a woman first.
Well, yeah, that is the thing about it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I had to really come into. But you know, I came into a prideful sense of being a woman. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you know, I had a certain internalized misogyny that I had to work out. And I came into a sense of pride as my of my female experience. And so that was a really wonderful time in the 80s, you know, when the women's movement, the women of color movement was really
You're listening to KNON 89 Point.
Yep.
Oops.
That was
Continue.
Us. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, so you talk about 1983. Youth Station has been around since 1983. That's when I started organizing AIDS and lesbians. Huh. And that was, and so, I mean, it was just a wonderful time to be talking about women's issues, lesbians' issues, and lesbian of color issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and when we say our show has been on that long, it was a gay and lesbian show. Actually, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was a gay show. And then a few years later, it became a gay and lesbian show. And we were trying to think who our first transgender guest was. It was in the mid-90s, and it was Kate Bornstein, who was here in Dallas for some event. And, you know, what a character she was. But, yeah, and that's when we became an LGBT show.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, so it's
really... I know, it's a process. So, right, going back to that question, I mean, that's kind of mirrored throughout the country that, you know, that was the way power was or where the voice was, the visibility. And it's a process over time. And it was really the mid-90s that the transgender movement started to take off in San Francisco. And that's when I got to really come out as transgender. And, you know, that's where we were fighting for equal rights, non-discrimination ordinance in San Francisco, healthcare access. And I got involved in the first large-scale research project on the transgender community through the San Francisco Department of Public Health. And this was, at the time, the largest study of transgender people anywhere in the world with over 500 participants and within healthcare and HIV prevention lens. And so, you know, that was some of the work that I did, the early work I did in the 90s.
Well, you know, one of our other guests was Chaz Bono in a different avatar as Chastity on one of our early guests on the show.
When Chastity was on as Chastity, it was the first time she was on a show speaking as a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was that long ago that Chaz was on.
And that was, what, 1990-something, right?
Yeah, 1990-something.
Mid-90s. Yeah, mid-90s. Yeah.
Okay,
but here's my question, and we need to stop for a break in just a couple of minutes. But before the show, Laron and I were talking, and, okay, so the first transgender woman in the United States was Christine Jorgensen, and that was, like, she dated from 1951. is when she went to Denmark and blah, 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 did everything, became a woman, or transitioned to a woman. And for years, more and more male-to-female transgender people were out there. When did female-to-male, not that you weren't there, you were there all along and just as many as male-to-female, but it's really recently that I've met and seen so many female to male. When did it become okay for you to be who you were? And I'm not sure if I'm even asking the question the right way.
I think, you know, we certainly did not have a community for reflection until the late 90s. And even in San Francisco, I mean, it was small enough that, you know, we knew everybody in the late 90s. And, you know, that was when, you know, people started to really come out and connect through an organization called FTMI, FTM International, Female to Male International. And, you know, people the meetings were very well attended once a month, and people would really connect for support about what they were going through and also to share resources, particularly around healthcare, which people continue to do. You know, we really look to each other to get our education around our health, since a lot of times healthcare institutions aren't providing health education for us. And so that was, that time in the 90s that people started to really come out, and, you know, there started to be more recognition of transgender folks being female to male. But even now, I think, you know, the general public equates the concept of transgender with male to female experience.
Well, it's just been out there so much longer, so there are so many more of them.
Well, but in actuality...
people who've actually transitioned.
It seems that way. When we come back from a break, can you talk a little about, if you know, about any hard numbers about...
Trans men compared to trans
women. But we need to take a break.
We need to take a break. We're talking to Willie Wilkinson. His new book is Born on the Edge of Race and Gender. He's a writer, public health consultant, and Willie, stick with us. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
This is Liz from UT Arlington, and I listen to Lambda Weekly podcasts at lambdaweekly.com.
The 2016 Dallas Martin Luther King Jr. and Parade and Celebration is coming up on Monday, January 18th. This year, there's going to be only one parade. Look for a KNON in this year's parade. For information to register to be in a parade, go to DallasMLK.com. To become a vendor or performer after the parade celebration in Fair Park, contact us at 214-938-4211.
Also, Red Hot and Blue presents the 17th annual KNON Blues Fest. This is a whole raft of, it's a great annual event. Lots of stars. Lucky Peterson, the Stratoblasters, the Benoit King Band, Buddy Whittington, Cookie McGee, just added James Butler and the Cool Show Band with special guest R.L. Griffin. The list goes on and on. It's Saturday, January 30th and Sunday, January 31st at Poor David's Pub, 1313 South Lamar. The doors will open at 3 on both days, and you can get more information and tickets at KNON.org.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Lauren Landis and the late Patty Fink, and we're talking to Willie Wilkinson. Willie's new book is Born on the Edge of Race and Gender. We're talking about male-to-female transgender issues. Willie, do you have any statistics about, or are there any even?
You mean we're talking about female to male?
Female to male transgender, yeah, and compared to male to female.
Well, you know, the estimate that is used is that there's 700,000 transgender people in the U.S., which I think many people think is a low estimate.
I think so.
I think it's very low.
And, you know, really, even though there is such a lack of visibility of trans masculine folks, female to male folks, you know, it's generally considered within the transgender community to be about even in numbers, female to male and male to female. But I think when you look at who's being represented in the media and where the conversation is, a lot of times it is, very skewed to the male to female spectrum. And so I think that leads people to think that there are more folks who are trans women or trans
I think there are more male to female transgender people who've transitioned, because there just wasn't the male to female to male community out there until, like you said, the late 90s.
But I don't know that that's the case. I mean, you mean who have transitioned now, or
who've actually transitioned? I mean, more and more are, which is good, because it's a healthy thing to do if that's who you are.
See, I disagree.
You disagree with me on that?
I think lots and lots of trans men have been out there, but they've moved on and gone on with their lives, and they're not in the activist community, which is where we see a lot of visibility.
Right. Well, also
there are so many trans masculine people who are doing incredible work on LGBT and trans specific issues.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
certainly, you know, some word work and do just kind of move on and, you know, aren't active and, you know, are stealth sometimes. But there are certainly a lot of people who are on a trans masculine spectrum who are doing incredible work, who are out there.
And not criticizing it at all. It's just observation kind of.
Willie, before the show, David and I were talking about, if we could get your take on it, possibly, maybe, how does surgery play into this as far as female to male transitioning? And because that wasn't even known that that was an option, was that even thought of, you know, back in the 70s or 80s like, okay, well, I can't transition because that they thought they had to, and we now know now you don't have to do that to legally transition.
Well, yeah, that's a great question, and you know, certainly people a surgery requirement should not be a surgery requirement for people to change their legal gender or to be recognized as the gender that they identify with.
And big news here in Texas, big news, huge news in Texas, as of last week. To get your birth certificate changed, you need a court order. It used to be you had to have an order from a surgeon. No more.
No
That's
more.
Gone, and they're changing birth certificates, and they're sealing the old birth certificate and reissuing a new one.
No way.
Yes.
Wow. That's
I mean, this
exactly.
is
awesome.
This is huge. This
is that
huge.
It is huge. And that's a wonderful thing. Yeah,
no, but you don't understand. In Texas.
Yes, I know. I know you have had your struggles. I know. And so, I mean, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Because really it's about people being able to live their lives authentically. And, you know, for some folks that does include surgery. And so I do have a very lengthy piece on genital surgery options for trans men in my book, because I'm using it to just, you know, I use my experience to highlight the need for comprehensive access to care in the United States. Because, you know, California is one of 12 states in the District of Columbia that on a state level requires health insurance companies to provide transition-related surgery coverage for folks. And it's still a challenge in these states, and it's certainly a challenge in states that don't have that insurance coverage. And many people really do want to access surgery, but it's just cost prohibitive. It's not something that's within reach if we don't have health insurance coverage, and it's medically necessary. Mm-hmm. You know, the American Medical Association and a whole bunch of other organizations have deemed this medically necessary. So I think it's an important question, and I think people really don't realize that the technological advances are mind-blowing in terms of what, you know, not only the technological advances, but the surgeons that we now have in the United States, and for some folks, being able to get health insurance coverage, it's a whole new day in terms of access to care for some trans men. But we need it to be for everyone around the U.S. and around the world. So I do describe in detail what that experience is like, and you know what is now possible medically in terms of phalloplasty, in particular, creation of a penis for trans men.
You go around and you speak at a lot of places, and particularly college campuses. So
yes.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the response from, you know, the students or whoever attends. I think just the general public, in my opinion, just the general public, you know, they're so confused about what trans is and what trans isn't. And do you get some of the same, like, just confused questions or looks from, I guess, your heterosexual students? And LGBT students.
I mean, I've been providing LGBTQ training and transgender-specific training since the 90s, or 80s, actually. I started training on lesbian issues in the 80s. But, you know, I've been training folks for a long time. So I train a lot of community health providers, mental health, substance abuse, medical, public health providers. And I've worked on campuses in various academic departments. And, you know, across the board, you know, those are the kinds of questions that I do get. And I invite people to ask their burning questions and give people an opportunity to problem solve and, mm-hmm. and talk about their challenges and concerns around this issue. And, you know, all over, I think there are people who have questions, very basic questions about transgender experience. It's something that people are having difficulty wrapping their minds around. Mm-hmm. But once they understand more, you know, what that experience is, then we can talk about, well, you know, how do you navigate the interactions with folks so that you're referring to them appropriately? And then how can we create systems that are trans-affirming? Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's in health care, health-related systems, or we're talking about educational systems. And, you know, certainly on campuses, there are a lot of challenges, you know, many students have difficulty changing their ID. If they change their name, there's all this bureaucratic hassle, you know, that they're being misgendered. You know, the teacher is calling out on the class roster the wrong name, and so people are being outed. You know, so there are a lot of different situations that are coming up in college campuses. At the same time, I see this incredible engagement and this burgeoning community of trans and gender nonconforming students who are really and allies who are excited about these mm-hmm. issues. So it's an incredible time. You know, people are really talking about these issues now in a way that they never did. So, you know, it's kind of nice to be trans now.
mm-hmm. Right.
Well, you know, here in Texas, we've had, you know, the whole ruckus in Houston over HERO, the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance. Where yeah. they really took off, didn't attack lesbian and gay people and bisexual people. They really targeted the trans community.
Big time.
And Dallas has had an ordinance, a similar ordinance now in our Dallas City Charter, that's been in place for 13 years, and we've never had any of those so-called bathroom issues and all of that. But it really is targeting the trans community in the same way that the visibility that of the lesbian gay community, say 20 years ago, when we were being called pedophiles and all of that, and
right.
so I think the trans movement's kind of a number of years behind where we are now in terms of the LGB part. Do you think that there is a is it helpful or is it hurtful to be LGBT, or should the T be a fight on its own? Because there's a lot of discussion now in the community about you know, are we to be allies or do we to be out there in front as an LGBT community, or should the T community take the lead and people follow? What are your thoughts on that? What's the state of what is your view on the state of the movement for trans equality?
Oh, okay. Well, those are a lot of questions. I mean, yeah. First of all, you know, I think that, you know, it's a sad situation that trans people were, you know, have been demonized, and, you know, the bathroom is really the lightning rod now since marriage equality is a mm-hmm. done deal. I think, you know, we have a number of bathroom harassment bills in a number of states where trans people are being criminalized for just basically using the facilities, mm-hmm. a basic human right. I think another point there is that, you know, in all these years of policies that are gender-affirming and allowing people to, you know, basically use the facilities in accordance with their gender identity, there have never been problems in the restroom. There's no situation where a trans person hurt anybody. They're just trying to pee in peace, you mm-hmm. know, like everybody else.
Exactly. Nowhere in the United States, in no city.
Yeah.
Not happened.
So it's not happening, and yet that was used with HERO, you know, like, oh, you know, your daughter is going to get attacked in the bathroom. You know, I mean, come on. That is just fear mongering.
In one
right?
of the suburbs north of here, Plano, they passed a non-discrimination ordinance. Mm-hmm. They left out a number of things, and one of the things they left out, there is no mention of bathroom. Well,
no, there's an affirmative act. There's an affirmative statement in it that says bathrooms are based upon genitalia.
Oh, okay. Anyway.
Which is seriously wrong.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think if you're going to have a non-discrimination ordinance, I mean, it really needs to be basically people can access public accommodations based on their gender identity expression. And
right.
everybody has the right to use the facilities.
And especially now once people will be getting birth certificates in Texas that reflect who they are, and not their body necessarily, but who they are and who a court has said, yes, you have transitioned and you get that birth certificate. Well, what happens if that person has not had surgery yet, has a birth certificate, says, I'm female?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you can't ask people to show their birth certificate to use a restroom.
Exactly. I'm talking about if you have to defend yourself. Mm-hmm. If there are – anyway, my whole point about Plano was the opposition gets so nuts that in the recall petition, all they talked about was the bathroom bill, the bathroom bill, the bathroom bill.
Right.
Or the bathroom ordinance. And there was no bathroom ordinance. Every single signature in Plano was thrown out because there is no bathroom ordinance, and Plano's city charter says that you have to – characterize the ordinance accurately, and it didn't.
And the thing is, they even won in Plano. They had what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It said you could kick somebody out of a public accommodation
mm-hmm.
if you didn't think their genitalia was matching the restroom that they were.
Right. Well, and how are the people going to know that? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Right.
The genitalia police.
I mean, it's like I think people don't realize we need basic human rights. We need mm-hmm. civil rights protections
right.
on a federal level based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And I write about that in my book because yep. it's like, you know, now we have marriage equality. We really need to be looking at all the other ways that LGBT folks are discriminated against, which goes back to your other question. You know, I think, you know, trans folks are doing incredible things, and trans folks should be given opportunities to be leaders on trans issues. But there's a great way in which we work together as LGBTQ folks mm-hmm. in the movement. Because there's, you know, there's so many ways in which our needs intersect. And, you know, when someone gets run out of the women's room, it may not be because they're transgender. It could be because they're a gender nonconforming dyke. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there's ways in which we, you know, our experience intersects and, you know, and we are the ways that we describe ourselves are different. But, you know, we get targeted because we're showing visual gender nonconformity. And that's uncomfortable to folks, whether or not we identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual, or transgender, or queer. You know, so you know, I think let's work together on these issues. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And you know, another thing that we don't talk about in the gay community much is when we're talking about job security. If a gay or lesbian person loses their job because they're gay or lesbian. They didn't lose their job because they were gay or lesbian, chances are. Chances are it was because that gay man was not masculine enough, that lesbian was too butch. And really they're losing their job in most cases because of gender identity. And not that you know, not that Patty
gender
has
expression. Gender expression.
Gender expression. Gender expression, how you're expressing yourself, right. How you appear outwardly.
That's part of it, but certainly people who might be considered gender normative are discriminated against because of their sexuality.
Sure, they are.
What is it? 17 states you can get married on a Sunday and get lose your job on a Monday. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's really just the fact that people know you have a same sex desire, regardless of your gender expression, can be a reason to be discriminated.
You know, and that's a new thing now that we can all get married. But for years, the main reason gay and lesbian people were being fired was because of their gender expression.
Yeah.
It's just – it really is a way that trans and gay, lesbian, bi intersect a whole lot more.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, yeah, absolutely. We can mm-hmm. all get married, but there are so many mm-hmm. ways in which we still get discriminated against. And I think
right.
that knowledge of you know, this person is queer in some way, you know, is certainly mm-hmm. impacting so many people, right?
We need to take a break in just a couple of minutes, but how do you think the experience is different now? I have met so many trans kids at all the GSAs in the schools, at our LGBT youth group that we have here in the city. I've met so many trans kids. Their experience can't be the same as a trans person who transitions later in life.
Okay. Do you need to go to the break, or you want
No, go ahead. Let's just start this. We have a couple of minutes, and then we need to break. But do you agree that your life would have been a whole lot easier had you been actually able to – you knew who you were, but if you were really able to transition as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I would have appreciated being affirmed and supported and accepted and loved for who I was, mm-hmm. rather than having to, you know, fight with that or feel bad about myself about who I was. You know, but it's hard to say. I mean, at the same time, like I said, I had an experience with the women of color movement and the lesbian movement that I wouldn't have had if I had been allowed to transition. But, you know, I really would have wanted to as a child. I mean, I was showing that I was trans from a very young age. And, you know, what would that have been like, you know, if I had been affirmed in my gender from an early age? And you know, and it recognized in the way that, you know, more and more people are starting to recognize. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, we need more resources for families. So, because it starts with the family, and sometimes the school is recognizing this, a child's gender identity, but the family is not able to recognize that, or not, you know, not able to affirm that. And so there are challenges there. We need more and more resources for families, particularly families of color, to really have a way to talk about these issues and to get support.
And to get support is huge.
Yeah,
I think that's a big, big part of it. Is imagine a kid feeling alone. Making their way through their journey, but a parent feeling alone, and how do I deal with this? I have no one to talk to. I'm afraid to talk to my best friends or family members or, you know, other friends. You know, where do you turn? And so it's a real struggle, I can imagine. And so it's great to see these support groups popping up around the country. That people can really turn to, because it's not just us, it's it's all of those people around us, you know?
Yeah, and more parents and other caregivers who are standing up and supporting their trans kids, and that is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. It is.
Because they see. They see how much happier their kid is when they can be affirmed.
And they see how to affirm them.
Everybody wants their kid to be happy. You know, and a lot of times they think, oh, well, they're not going to be happy as this, so I have to resist it. We have to try to change this.
And when I was asking the question, what I was really saying was, I've met all these kids at the Gay Straight Alliances and youth groups. These are happy kids and well-adjusted kids. We need to take a break. We can talk about this a little bit more. We're talking to Willie Wilkinson. His new book is Born on the Edge of Race and Gender. I'm Dave Taffet here with the late Patty Fink and Laron Landis. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
Hi, this is Patty Fink, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And I'm Dave Taffet, and I'm here with the late Patty Fink and Laron Landis. When you recorded that, Patty, you did not say that you were the late Patty Fink.
I did not.
You did not.
Yeah. I'm alive, though.
We need to re-record. Re-record.
We do need to do some re-recording. We're talking to Willie Wilkinson. His book is Born on the Edge of Race and Gender. Willie, where's your book available?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, Smashwords, online, or you can order through your local bookstore.
Right.
Oh, awesome.
Good. Okay, so just before the break, we were talking about kids transitioning young, and they're healthy and happy kids.
Yes.
Mental illness in the transgender community was rampant because people weren't able to transition. I mean, it's a not simple, but it is really a simple solution. If somebody is male, let them be male, and then they're happy. It's working with kids. What are some of the other things that you've noticed about it, though, with kids?
Let me just clarify. I wouldn't say that mental illness was rampant, and I think we want to be careful about the
way. But the suicide rate has been so high, unforgivably high.
That the stress of discrimination is what we're talking about, not a pathological experience.
Oh, no, no, no.
People have experienced a lot of stress because of discrimination that they experience. And yes, the suicide rate is higher than ever. And even now in 2016, I mean, here we are with so many resources, so many opportunities to get education And we're, you know, in 2015, we lost more people to suicide than ever. And young people, leaders, you know, and that is a tragic, tragic situation. So, you know, we are still losing people. And you know, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, mm-hmm. We're on the Edge of Race and Gender, because, you know, I feel like the time is now. We need to be talking about these issues. We need to be providing opportunities to uplift young trans folks and trans people everywhere. We need to be looking at what does it take to create trans-affirming systems throughout society, in education, in healthcare, in housing, in employment, in all these different spheres that people are being discriminated against.
Why do you think that is, that the suicide rate is higher than ever?
Especially with all the resources that are available.
That's terrible.
Now.
Well, I mean, it's really heartbreaking to see particularly young trans leaders who have such great promise, mm-hmm. who are feeling overwhelmed. I think in this age of the internet, that there's a wonderful way in which there are resources available. There's also a way in which there's so much information, and when people are negative online, it's very hurtful. And I think people experience bullying on another level because mm-hmm. of the way that, you know, social media works and so forth. So, I think
and not just from kids, not just among kids. I think adults are bullied
across
just as heavily.
Yes.
And, you know, one other thing can be, we live in a little liberal bubble here in Dallas, surrounded by, you know, it's red going 200 miles in any direction from here. We have resources here. I don't know what they have up on the Red River or lower Oklahoma. Probably not a whole lot. And that's probably part of it, because transgender people obviously are everywhere.
But some of these kids, and I forgot the young man's name, but it was one of the tragedies of last year. A young man, a trans man of color, was
Blake
voted.
Brockington.
I'm sorry?
Are you talking about Blake Brockington?
That might be his name, but he was voted the homecoming king.
Yes.
And he had, from all outward appearances, had just a. As much a support as any trans kid could ever ask for, including his family, yet he still took his life. So
actually, he did not experience family acceptance.
He didn't?
A foster family, and then he aged out of the system.
Gotcha. Okay.
And was homeless. And, you know, I think the stress of, you know, and what a wonderful leader to be the first homecoming king in his school.
Yeah.
And yet,
yeah.
You know, the stress of that much attention, you know, it's hard when people are being negative, and it's about your personal life. It's about who you are, people being negative about who you are. It's very difficult to deal with. And so, I mean, yes, he was only 18 years old, and you know, yeah, that was so, so sad.
It
so,
was.
So sad. Yeah.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit. In your book, you talk about allies, and I loved reading this section of the book because I so agree. You know, how we need to not only acknowledge our allies, and, you know, you talk about how sometimes they don't use all of the correct terms, but they're not our enemy, but they're still our and they have good intent. And why is that important?
That's the beautiful thing for me as a trainer. That I have had the opportunity to experience, that there are a lot of people mm-hmm. who want to do the right thing, and they want the tools to do it. And they may come from, you know, the language that they're hearing in the media, which is not totally trans-affirming, and they might call somebody, or they might say, you know, I mean normal people, you know, in opposition to LGBT or something
right.
like that.
Right.
They might just, you know, language such as that. And, you know, yet I think, they're coming from the heart. They want to.
They are,
right.
Sure.
And they're added training because they want to know how to do a better job. And so, you know, that's, you know, why I've used my book as a, you know, basically using memoir as a tool to illuminate these issues. So it's basically a cultural competency tool. Like, how can you, you know, understand this issue and then take it back to your work setting in community health or in education or, you know, talking to your neighbor, you know, in your workplace, those kinds of things. How can you be, you know, have more understanding about this and recognize the ways we need to create systems that are trans-affirming?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the words in the gay community that usually drives people nuts is sexual preference.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't bother me at all, and you know why? If it's my preference to be gay, I'm going to be gay, and I have that right. And people who are using that are generally not using it to be malicious. Some are because they know it sets off buttons, but generally they're not.
I think we can tell from actions, especially if it's someone that we know, we can tell what the intentions are and what they're trying to say. You know, we, meaning us and other people who are involved in the gay community, we talk about this day in, day out. So we are on top of the latest term to use. And so, I think we sometimes do ourselves a disservice when we jump on folks for not using the correct terms, and we know that's not their intent. How do we educate them in a nice way?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a good question because, sometimes the language can be upsetting because, people resonate or they hear it in a way that is, has been hurtful, has been used in a hurtful way, or in a way that is not treating them as an equal.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is important to meet people where they're at. And sometimes it's imperfect, in the ways that we try to educate somebody. The thing about terms is that, it varies so much in terms of how people resonate with these terms. And, language can change from block to block, community.
Absolutely.
And generation to generation. Sexual preference is one of those terms that's an older term that has gone out. We say sexual orientation now, but, some people are still using that term. And I think it's important for people to know. It's not necessarily a preference.
I'm not saying that I use that term at all, because I don't. I'm just saying I don't find it that insulting, because if I prefer to be gay, I'm going to be gay, and my two co-hosts know that nobody tells me what I should and shouldn't do. Because,
that's right.
Willie, I do.
Like you say, it's a right. It's a right to be who you are, and that's really the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, and particularly in the transgender movement, we're saying, it's our right to live authentic lives, to be who we are, and to be recognized for who we say we are, as being true to ourselves. So that I think like that, when you're saying, well, this is who I am, that's the bottom line.
Right.
And to be treated with respect and dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Instead of abuse and, violence.
Right.
Yeah. That's a good thing.
We were talking a little bit before about healthcare access, and that is one of the things that you do, is you're a public health consultant. What are some of the things that you've seen, aside from transition surgery, that hurt the trans community in getting access to health care?
Well, everything from, there's a need for basic cultural competency.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think a lot of times what's difficult for trans and gender nonconforming folks seeking health care is that they may be misgendered, or everybody from the frontline office staff to the medical provider referring to them in a way that's inappropriate or not recognizing them, when they're saying, this is who I say I am.
Mm-hmm.
I think that many health care providers, and I want to use that, or I should say community health providers in a large in a broad way. So everyone from medical to nursing, public health, substance abuse, mental health providers,
therapists,
there's just a range
that,
it can be difficult for folks to access care because they're not sure if they're going to be treated with respect. They're not sure if their trans identity or their gender nonconformity is going to be used against them. You're trusting someone to be an authority on your health in a certain way when it's hard to trust them as respecting you. So that basic cultural competency issue. And then I also think that there are changing needs on a medical level in terms of the medical competency, that we really need to see more providers understand what the healthcare needs are for trans folks. Everything from hormone administration to understanding, how to read somebody's blood workup because they have medically transitioned. And if they do access surgery, what their healthcare needs are post-surgically. So those are some of the issues. Everything on a systemic level, how are people filling out the intake forms? Is there an awareness about gender in the intake forms? Are people being asked appropriate questions about their sexual orientation and their gender identity in a way that is consistent and non-discriminatory?
There's a recent, not so recent, I guess, it was in the last year where there was a trans health fail was a hashtag on Twitter, mm-hmm. and people were sharing their experiences, obtaining health care and trying to obtain health care out in the marketplace. And so many people shared stories of having to educate their providers, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. the education wasn't there, and they're not teaching it in medical schools, and they're not, right. there is no cultural competence for most providers who have a professional license, supposed to be top of their game, and they know nothing. And in fact, a lot of the abusive language and denial of service and that sort of thing is coming from providers who should know better, mm-hmm. but they don't. It's exciting that there are folks out there like you who are educating people, and that's really what it takes, is to enlighten them.
Do you know what I think would help a lot? We need a lot more transgender doctors. I go to a gay doctor. I go to a gay dentist. I have a gay eye doctor. Any doctor can examine my eyes. I just don't even want to deal with it. I go to a gay doctor. I think having more transgender doctors actually is part of the solution, because they'll be interacting in medical school. They'll be interacting with the people that they partner with the hospitals that they're dealing with. And I think that's an important part of it.
To be able to get through their educational experience without being discriminated against, so they can continue further to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'd love to see that, but I'd also love to see many trans-affirming doctors.
Absolutely.
What I'm saying is I think that would help other doctors become more trans-affirming, because mm-hmm. then doctors would have a colleague that they can go to with their questions. Doctors go to each other all the time with questions, and...
Yeah, and I think there's a wonderful network of doctors who are not trans, who have been working mm-hmm. with trans patients and clients for so long that are building expertise. And yes, we need to have more trans people be part of that community. Because, 50% of people had to educate their providers about being transgender, from the large-scale survey the National Center for Transgender Equality and LGBTQ Task Force did a few years back. 28% were harassed in the doctor's office.
That's insane.
2% were physically attacked. Wow. That is just wrong.
Yeah, physically attacked.
First, do no harm. Out the window.
Absolutely. So in my book, I actually am born in the Edge of Race and Gender. The subtitle is A Voice for Cultural Competency. In the end of the book, I have resources for community health providers, educational institutions, and businesses to assess their transgender cultural competency.
Hmm.
So they can look at it, are we mm-hmm. doing this? Are we doing this? And look at, what are some of the questions? What are some of the systems issues that folks need to look at?
What are some of the things that somebody who is transgender going to a doctor, what should they look for? Obviously, if you're attacked in the office, get out of there and call the police. And I'm serious about that. But what are some of the less obvious things that that people should look for?
Well, certainly respectful practice. Mm-hmm. I love to see visible cues that a healthcare institution or organization is LGBTQ or trans affirming. So visible cues in the waiting room and treatment rooms and on the website, that have some sort of recognition of diversity, hate-free zone information, mm-hmm. or actual very specific LGBT-friendly or trans-friendly information. I think the data collection issue, as I mentioned, is important. Do they actually ask questions about gender identity, and how do they word it? You can't just say male, female, other. It's not like that. People aren't saying, oh, they're other. But really looking at, how are people talking about trans experience? And are people asking everybody how they identify their gender? What sex were they assigned at birth? And what pronouns are appropriate for them?
Mm-hmm.
Those are important questions. Are they aware of the research? Are they able to help people connect to other resources that are trans-affirming? There's a range of ways that people can be culturally competent, and how do they handle gender-specific settings in particular? So that might be restroom access, support groups, residential accommodations and treatment facilities and bed placement, year analysis, all those pieces, you know, how are those handled in a way that's affirming to someone's gender identity?
I think there's some exciting things coming out of the Obama administration under the Affordable Care Act that are going to be great.
Yes.
Like Meaningful Use 3 now offers it's going to be a requirement that you have at least the buckets to capture sexual orientation, gender identity expression, you know, so that they're there if it's relevant to care. So, you know, those are cool things, but it's an exciting time to watch those things. You know, an EEO, so many things coming forward to get that kind of an affirmation from the federal government. It's cool.
Willie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Willie.
We are out of time. The hour flew. Willie Wilkinson, his new book is Born on the Edge of Race and Gender. I enjoyed it.
I did too.
Yeah, it's
great book.
Something I'd recommend.
Thank
you so much for being with us today.
I hope you'll come back and be on the show again.
I'd love to.
Good, thank you.
All right.
And we'll be back with more Lambda Weekly next week.